Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
House lawmakers are proposing another $25,000 in homestead exemptions, but local officials say the loss in revenue could shred their budgets.
This is not a tax break. This is a tax shift.
Also tonight, will a new payment system for Florida nursing homes lock Medicaid patients out?
Many of the nursing homes that the Florida Healthcare Association represents will run up against that cliff.
We'll also get the latest on proposed changes to Florida's election rules and the state's Stand Your Ground gun law, plus an observance in honor of crime victims that turned into criticism of a Central Florida prosecutor. I'm Tom Flanagan. We've reached the halfway mark of the 2017 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. The Florida House is advancing its plan for cutting taxes. Nick Evans reports on top of nearly $300 million in reductions, lawmakers want to increase the homestead exemption by half.
The tax measures lawmakers like to talk about are simple, straightforward. Sales tax holidays, fee cuts, and rate reductions. But the hard work often hits a bit closer to home, as in property taxes. The dollars Floridians pay on their homes play a big role in funding education and local projects. Whenever lawmakers propose changes, conflict isn't far behind. But Wednesday, St. Cloud Republican Representative Mike LaRosa did just that. He wants a constitutional amendment making another $25,000 of a home's value tax-exempt.
The current exemption applies to the assessed value between $50,000 and $75,000. The proposal would increase the exemption to apply to the assessed value between $50,000 and $100,000, only, again, for non-school taxes. If voters approve the amendment, it will take into effect beginning in 2019.
The tab for this change to the homestead exemption comes to slightly more than $750 million, and the brunt of the revenue reduction will fall on local governments.
I do not believe that it is impossible for local government to be able to sharpen their pencil and make the obligations that are required. Yes, there will be some tough decisions. I recognize that.
But opposition from local leaders was swift and unified.
There aren't enough pencils in Orange County for us to sharpen to make up this shortfall.
That's Orange County Commissioner Betsy Vanderlei. And Polk County Commissioner John Hall offers a similar rebuke.
This is not a tax break. This is a tax shift. We're going to have to consider increasing taxes. We're going to have to increase the millage rate. So what have we actually accomplished if we do this? Nothing.
But Cape Coral Republican Representative Dane Eagle has doubts about the dire financial straits local officials predict. He recalls the push for the Save Our Homes Amendment limiting property tax assessments.
And I had the opportunity to travel around the state, meet with local governments, heard many tales of woe about how the sky was going to fall, how there was no way that they could cut, and that they would have to raise property taxes. In one of those meetings, I was given a very nice clock and a pen, thanks for being here, with the name of the county on it, and I sent it back and said, well, let's start here, and let's find other places to cut.
Still, the mood on the panel didn't quite break along party lines. Lantana Democrat Al Jaquette offered a last-minute amendment, tripling the exemption. Fellow Democrats and LaRosa himself balked at the fiscal impact, and the amendment was withdrawn. Meanwhile, Republican Don Hanfelt from the Villages took a swipe at LaRosa's proposal.
This is an idea that is great in intention, but is at best a feel-good for legislators, and it's going to be devastating to our communities.
The committee approved the provision. It's only public hearing before the House floor. If 3/5 of the House and Senate agree on the idea, it's heading for next year's ballot. The Senate so far hasn't shown much interest and has yet to file a similar proposal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A proposed payment system for nursing homes is dividing the industry, with some praising a proposal in the Senate and others saying it will hurt access to nursing homes for Medicaid patients. Lynn Hatter reports.
The state spends about $5 billion in its Medicaid nursing home program. The money goes to providers who care for low-income seniors who can't afford to pay the expenses themselves. Florida lawmakers have sought to streamline how they pay for nursing care, and that solution could be in the form of a proposal pending before the Florida Senate.
FHCA represents 82% of the 600-plus nursing skilled centers across Florida, and we applaud the legislature for tackling the complicated issue of a prospective payment system. The Senate put forth great efforts to deliver a plan that has broad consensus among all nursing center types.
Emmett Reed is president of the Florida Healthcare Association, which represents the majority of the state's nursing homes. He's backing a Senate plan that would increase funding to nursing facilities by about $60 million for the next few years. In exchange for the extra money, the nursing homes are discouraged from seeking retroactive payments to the state. The program would be phased in over the next few years. The FHA opposed an earlier version of the proposal, but is now on board. Tom Parker is with the organization.
They want to make sure that the money is going to take care of Medicaid residents, not Medicare residents. Moved a few counties around to regions where they made more sense geographically. So there was lots of little changes. There's a quality work group created to continue to evaluate this system as we move forward and make any necessary changes that are going to be needed in a few years.
It was the extra money that won over the FHCA. But Leading Age Florida, another group that represents continuing care facilities and some nursing homes, worries their members will be hurt by the trade-off.
We are, I think, reasonably skeptical that a $60 million increase in the Medicaid budget will be funded every year for the next 5 years.
Steve Ballmer represents Leading Age Florida.
And again, my point on that is that it doesn't really matter when the transition funding runs out. When it does, these nursing homes and the others we represent, and in fact, many of the nursing homes that the Florida Healthcare Association represents, will run up against that cliff.
And he argues many of his members, which are highly rated by the state, will see budget cuts, while lower-rated nursing homes will see payment increases. Leading Age has been criticized by the FHCA as a vocal minority. But Rob Goldstein with Menor Manor in Pinellas County says his nursing home would be one of the losers.
Under the Florida Healthcare Plan, I will have no alternative than to reduce our Medicaid census. We simply will not be able to afford to take care of this population to the extent that we have historically been able to do so.
Leading Age says the payment shift could mean most of the organization's private pay residents will see costs go up in order to compensate for losses on the Medicaid side. But the Florida Healthcare Association argues its group, which has more members, has a better feel on the industry. The Senate proposal is similar to a plan worked on by the Agency for Healthcare Administration that was rejected by the House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, changes to Florida's Stand Your Ground law came up for a floor vote today.
The question is, who will speak for the voiceless victims, silenced by an aggressor who is protected by flawless law? Flipping the burden of proof will only lead to more deaths.
Some Florida victims recall their horror at the hands of criminals.
When he said that, my heart sank because I knew he didn't want my money, he didn't want my van, he didn't want to steal from me. He had something really sinister planned.
And Florida lawmakers consider a number of bills to ensure the state's elections are on the up and up.
There was an election where two votes made the difference.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Instead of heading to the governor, a Stand Your Ground-related bill is now headed back to the Senate for approval. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's after the House passed its own version of the bill today.
Today, the accused who claims Stand Your Ground can avoid a trial if they can prove to a judge their self-defense claim is justified during a pretrial immunity hearing. But the Senate measure shifts that burden to prove the initial claim from the defendant to the prosecutor.
The Senate bill amends the Stand Your Ground law to shift the burden of proof from the defendant to the state.
That's Black Republican Representative Bobby Payne. He's the sponsor of the House bill, which now includes a new change that still shifts the burden to prosecutors but lowers the standard for the state.
The state is required to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a defendant is not entitled to immunity when the defendant raises a prima facie case of immunity.
Still, despite the lower standard, many Democrats remain opposed to the measure, including Democratic Representative Bobby DeBose.
The stand your ground law has already resulted in an increase in homicides in Florida.
Lantana Democratic Representative Lori Berman says this could also have a negative impact on domestic violence cases.
So in the event that there's no witnesses to come forward and the woman who was the victim of domestic violence is not alive to testify, aren't you concerned that it will allow the abuser to get away with it by shifting the burden?
And while Payne acknowledges that could be a valid circumstance, he says he just has a different philosophy on why he believes the burden should be shifted. Bringing up an old argument, House Democratic leader Janet Cruz says there's also going to be an added financial burden on prosecutors who expect a rise in self-defense claims if the bill becomes law.
So how do you plan to ensure that prosecutors have the resources to cover the additional burden that this new law would put in place for them? And are we, in essence, looking to pass something that will have an unfunded mandate?
Not only does he disagree with that assessment, Payne says the cost would be lower for prosecutors because the new bill lowers the standard.
We have heard that the cost could potentially be negligible and reduce those costs based on the fact that we're not at the highest standard of burden.
Still, even with the approval of his chamber, Payne's House bill differs from the Senate version. And Fleming Island Republican Rob Bradley, the bill's Senate sponsor, says, quote, his chamber's position on the issue is contained in the version that passed the Senate last month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Governor Rick Scott and Attorney General Pam Bondi are commemorating National Crime Victims' Rights Week as controversy continues to swirl around Orange County State Attorney Aramis Ayala's decision not to seek the death penalty. As Jim Ash reports, the keynote speaker, a rape survivor and a nationally known victims' advocate, is reserving judgment.
National Crime Victims' Rights Week began like most solemn ceremonies at the Capitol. The Capitol Police Honor Guard presented the colors. A handful of crime victims and law enforcement officers rose for the pledge. Tallahassee police investigator David Alford read a short prayer. But then, an unassuming Miami suburbanite named Julie Wheels stepped to the lectern and described every mother's nightmare.
I don't say this lightly. People in support of victims save the lives of people like me. I wouldn't be standing here today if it wasn't for the care I received from that first 911 call I made on October 16, 2002.
Will went on to describe what happened that day at high noon when she put her 8-month-old son in the car and drove a few blocks to pick up her 3-year-old daughter at a church daycare. An assailant jumped into the minivan, smashed the back of her head, and asked Will if she believed in God. When Will told him yes, he told her good. She'd forgive him for what he was about to do.
And when he said that, my heart sank because I knew he didn't want my money, he didn't want my van, he didn't want to steal from me. He had something really sinister planned.
Will was beaten, driven to a remote spot in the Everglades, and raped 4 times as her children watched. She was eventually abandoned in a park across the street from her parents' house. Police used DNA evidence to link her assailant to the crime. It took 4 years, but Will eventually faced him in court. He was found guilty and sentenced to 7 life terms.
I want to tell you, justice is not a myth. Justice is real. The closure that comes from justice, it might not cure everything, but it cures something inside of you.
Will shared her story as the notion of crime and punishment is consuming most politicians in Florida. Governor Rick Scott is under fire to suspend Orange County State Attorney Aramis Ayala for refusing to seek the death penalty. Republican Representative Bob Cortez of Altamont Springs says Scott's decision to reassign murder cases doesn't go far enough.
Is this the best serving the interests of justice both for victims and defendants, also for the residents of the Ninth Judicial Circuit?
political sensitivities are heightened because Ayala is the first African-American state attorney. Her defenders point out that she's a constitutional officer who answers to the voters, not the governor. Ayala and others argue the death penalty is a poor deterrent and forces survivors to relive the horror through multiple trials and appeals. During the ceremony, Attorney General Pam Bondi couldn't help referring to the controversy, although she didn't mention Ayala by name. Bondi grew emotional as she praised another victim who survived a deadly shooting 13 years ago.
And I'm very proud to say that the monster that tried to kill Felita, killed her friend, and a 13-year-old little boy now sits on death row where he will remain by a 12-0 death recommendation. And that happened in 2004. So that's why we have the death penalty in the state of Florida.
But Weil declines to weigh in on the death penalty. She says she never would have survived her ordeal without an attentive prosecutor and seasoned victim advocates guiding her through the process. She says prosecutors should decide how to proceed on a case-by-case basis.
I do think it's important for there to be victim input into how cases are handled. I know for me that him receiving the ultimate sentence meant everything.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Some Florida sheriffs are slamming President Donald Trump's administration for claiming the sheriffs are refusing to detain undocumented people. They say they are cooperating with immigration and customs enforcement, but they can't detain someone in violation of their civil rights. More from Sarah Mueller.
Orange County Sheriff Jerry Deming says the Department of Homeland Security report accusing Florida counties of refusing to hold undocumented immigrants is wrong. He says federal immigration officials won't work with local sheriffs to lawfully detain undocumented people.
At the very least, it's a public perception nightmare for sheriffs across the country. We support and cooperate with ICE in their efforts to identify and deport criminal aliens. However, we also swear on the oath to protect, support, and defend the U.S. Constitution.
President Donald Trump signed an executive order in January requiring Homeland Security to publish weekly reports naming local jurisdictions that don't honor immigration holds. Counties listed as being uncooperative or having criteria for accepting detainers include St. Lucie, Broward, Marion, and Alachua counties. Alachua County Sheriff Sadie Darnell says she doesn't know why the county is on the list.
We have asked repeatedly for someone from the federal side to explain to us how the report is compiled, on what basis, what criteria is being used. And none of that explanation has been given to us.
The sheriffs say the problem is the detainers. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers send requests, called detainers, to sheriffs and jails, asking them to hold on to someone in custody after their local criminal cases are closed. For example, after charges are dismissed or after they've completed their jail sentence, the detainers allow ICE up to 2 days to check the person's immigration status and decide whether to deport them. In the U.S., the government can't keep someone locked up unless they're given due process, which requires law enforcement to show probable cause and get a warrant authorized by a judge. Federal courts have ruled that detainers are voluntary and local governments are liable if they hold someone unlawfully. Similar problems are playing out all over the country. Wayne Evans is the attorney for the Florida Sheriff's Association. He says he's watching an immigration detainer case heard by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court this week. Cambodian immigrant Suri Non Lun argues he should have been freed from jail in February after the state dropped criminal charges against him. But a Boston judge declined to release him because of a detainer. Lund's attorney argues the judge overstepped his bounds. The case could have implications for local authorities in Florida and across the country. Department of Justice attorney Joshua Press argues states have a built-in right to detain people in the country illegally. He says there's no law limiting local cooperation with ICE agents.
Without having any sort of identified limit, then if the Commonwealth or its officers, or in this case, the Boston Municipal Court, wants to cooperate with the federal government, we don't see any particular reason why that could not happen in this case.
Press also says newly issued detainers will have a warrant attached. Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Guattari says that solves nothing because they're not warrants signed by a judge and can only be served by immigration or Border Patrol officers.
It says that warrant, which they call an I-200 or an I-205 form, and I've got one here in front of me, is it says on there specifically who can serve it, and it is not us.
The Department of Homeland Security has published just two reports calling out local governments for declining detainer requests. The report says it shouldn't be the only factor in judging the level of local cooperation with immigration officers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Florida lawmakers want to phase out community redevelopment agencies that combat blight in slums. Complaints of misuse of funds and corruption are plaguing the CRAs, but Kate Payne reports local governments are fighting to save them.
Looking around Cascades Park in downtown Tallahassee, it's easy to see the benefits of CRAs. Community redevelopment agencies work with local governments and private contractors to restore blighted neighborhoods. In the case of Cascades, what used to be a vacant Superfund site is now a sprawling green space with trails and an amphitheater.
CRAs matter because in order for folks to want to live in our existing communities, in order for them to accommodate new residents, they need parks, they need sidewalks, they need these infrastructure things that are very basic, but that it takes redevelopment tools and funding tools to provide.
Thomas Hawkins is a growth management advocate with 1,000 Friends of Florida. He says CRAs are a unique way to prevent urban sprawl and protect natural land.
CRAs are one way that's not generally available to municipalities to raise tax increment financing from that geographic area, bond it across multiple years to make those investments that allow our communities to be livable places.
After a CRA invests in a neighborhood, it's able to collect taxes on the increased property value. But Representative Al Jaquette, a West Palm Beach Democrat, says the agencies aren't focusing that reinvestment in the areas that need it most.
Too often we have CRAs that are collecting funds from the community that is blighted, and yet the development is not necessarily being done there for what they're tasked to do.
Critics say money that could fund affordable housing and infrastructure is going to ballparks or street festivals instead. Lawmakers say the agencies have run their course. Valrico Republican Representative Jake Rayburn wants to prohibit new CRAs from forming and prevent existing groups from starting new projects after October 2017.
The projects that are happening inside these CRAs, the cities could do them without the CRA. They would just.
But local officials from Miami to Pensacola disagree, and they're coming to the Capitol to defend CRAs. Here's town manager Jim McCroskey of Greenville, the proud home of Ray Charles, population 817.
There's not a dime of state money in CRAs. It's fiscally neutral.
But lawmakers aren't convinced CRAs are working. They want agency officials to report economic impact data and do ethics training. Jeff Burton leads the CRA in the city of Palmetto and says he's open to those reforms.
Do we need to make CRAs more accountable, more transparent, more ethical? Absolutely. You know, that we should do that with every body of government that exists in the state of Florida and in the United States.
But Representative Joe Geller, a Dania Beach Democrat, says the ethical issues don't warrant phasing out the programs entirely.
I really would like to see that provision on no new CRAs replaced by something that might say no new CRAs unless, and let's put out some conditions, and if we need to change the basis for establishing one, that's fine. But this is a useful tool.
The bill sponsors say they're open to changing the language, but advocates are running out of time. The bill has one more committee stop before it heads to the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee considered a raft of elections-related legislation this week. Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers are moving forward with new elections rules they hope will balance the need for valid election results with the right of people to have ready access to the polls.
Orange Park Republican Senator Rob Bradley has a measure that seems to hit on both those points. It allows broader use of handicap-accessible voting machines, so when there's a line and nobody with special needs is waiting, anyone can use the machine to vote. It also imposes higher standards for a judge to extend polling hours in a county.
Last election cycle, poll hours at one precinct were extended by a judge because of a 5K race in a car accident.
Bradley says a higher standard is needed because the change can cause confusion for voters and is often pushed by one party or another.
We've seen over the last several election cycles sort of a day of race to the courthouse to try to extend hours. What that does is create some haphazard situations where polls are open in one jurisdiction, not in another jurisdiction. Frankly, it usually is done for strategic reasons. It's amazingly certain counties get chosen to be extended based on their political performance.
Lawmakers also considered a measure that would let voters drop their mail-in ballots off at early voting locations. The measure is sponsored by West Palm Beach Democratic Senator Bobby Powell, but an amendment from Jacksonville Republican Senator Aaron Bean would give election supervisors the ability to opt out. That's a red flag for Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Oscar Brainin.
I've asked the same question over and over again. Why would you not want this to happen? And I have really never gotten a good answer from them as to why they would want to say, okay, this is another method to get your vote in, and I may want to opt out of it.
Despite the concerns, the measure passed with the amendment attached. Meanwhile, a measure from Jacksonville Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson would give people a chance to address issues such as a mismatched signature on their provisional ballot. Gibson says election officials should make every attempt to ensure as many votes as possible are counted.
In Duval County, as Senator Bean is aware, there was an election where two votes made the difference, and they were provisionals that made the difference in the election.
Lawmakers are also moving forward with a plan to cross-check Florida voter rolls with those from other states to guard against double registration. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us each weeknight at this time throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.